I'm really glad that you presented this clip. You know, with the original Chicano moratoriums, that was a part of it. You know, the killings of Chicanos overseas in Vietnam, but also police brutality, police terror. And, you know, and I live in Boyle Heights, and in 2016, we had a massive number of killings just in our small neighborhood. There were six in under a year.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento River, Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Welcome to The Wheel. I'm Rebecca Chenelou, your local voice in the international movement to bring death out of the closet. I'm very happy to have you here to join in the conversation as we consider the mysteries of living, dying, loving, grieving, and honoring our dead. This show is about creating community, so there will be opportunities for you to participate both by sharing your input on our Facebook page at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook. Go ahead and pull it up right now. Or if you don't have Facebook, before we get started, let's thank some of the underwriters who make this show possible. The Wheel is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Deborah Lucero and Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture, producing community festivals and events including Arttoberfest, the True North Tour, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. We're also supported by Chico Custom Cabinetry, creating fine custom kitchen and bath cabinets and more. Chico Custom Cabinetry can create your dream kitchen or bathroom. They work with all budgets, and there's no charge for consultations or estimates. Licensed and bonded, you can reach Chico Custom Cabinetry at 324-0032, at ChicoCustomCabinetry.com, and on Facebook. The motto at Chico Custom Cabinetry is, if you can dream it, we can build it. Thanks to our underwriters. And welcome back to this episode of The Wheel. Tonight, we will be considering death and community. In our modern American culture, where freedom of choice to do what we want trumps pretty much everything else, including caring about community, it seems valuable to think about what can be gained by gathering together in the face of dying and death. Yet we often hesitate to talk about these things. Well, my friends, tonight we will. In addition to our fun game called Who Died This Month, where we feature the music of a musician deceased during the month of August, I will be in conversation with Trey Ling Tu, a mother, school teacher, and self-proclaimed very normal person who will share stories of her experiences of community and death in Boulder, Colorado. In our This American Death segment, we'll hear a personal experience of community and healing from local friend Barbara Roberts. And as usual, we will have news of the movement, an exit tip for your exit plan, and some excellent music to hold it all together. We hope you'll plan to stay with us the whole show. And as always, your comments and shared experiences are welcome at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook. Now, before we dive in, let's remember some favorite musicians who died in August. Glenn Campbell, Jerry Garcia, Aretha Franklin, Elvis Presley, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. What song by one of these musical now stars in our cosmos do you think I will feature at our break? See? There's our first mystery. I was living in the Bay Area when Jerry died, and I attended his memorial in Golden Gate Park. We'll never forget it. Hard to imagine a community more torn up than the Deadheads when Jerry died. Well, unless you think about how the world cried when Elvis died. In fact, Elvis Week just wrapped up at Graceland. They honor him every year. And how many of you tuned in to at least a part of Aretha's service? So there's lots of exciting possibilities for Who Died This Month. Before we get to that, let's dive into this topic of death and community. Of course, this conversation could go many directions. Why do we gather? How do we gather? What do my loved ones need? What do I hope will happen? Practical considerations, religious considerations, debates about whether it's necessary to gather at all. I'm keeping the definition of community very general here tonight. In our short time together, we won't be able to cover all of this, but I want to get us thinking and talking about our personal experiences of death and dying in the context of how we do and do not come together. How do we come together for each other before, during, and after a death? Have you experienced a time when you felt the power of community when someone died? Do you know of instances where death was more lonely than it needed to be? For me, ideas about death in the village first came from my friend Holly Pruitt and one of her teachers, Stephen Jenkinson. Stephen Jenkinson, he's an author, teacher, and creator of the Orphan Wisdom School. He has master degrees from Harvard University in theology and the University of Toronto in social work, and he's a popular voice in the movement to improve the end-of-life experience in North America. If you don't know about Stephen, he is worth checking out, and I will put a link on the Wheel Facebook page. In addition to his many years of working with the dying as a palliative care professional, he's a master storyteller. He's featured in the documentary Grief Walker, which I highly recommend. It's absolutely beautiful to watch. He's a sculptor, a traditional canoe maker, and he built a house that won a Governor General's Award for Architecture. What an intro! What is his message? Here we go. Jenkinson says, Over many years, I was routinely obliged to contend with what, on the surface, looked like personal dilemmas with regard to dying. It took me a little while to recognize that what I was seeing really had very little to do with people's personal association with, memories of, or relationship to the idea or the realities of dying. It had much more to do with the fact that people in any culture inherit their understandings of dying much more than they create them. And I'm going to read that once more. People in any culture inherit their understandings of dying much more than they create them. Going on, he says, in our case, that inheritance takes the form of an extraordinary degree of aversion to and dread of dying. My phrase for it was that the culture is incontrovertibly and for the most part unconsciously death phobic. That's the end of his quote. Later on, he calls it culture failure. And it's a pretty critical assessment. But it does explain a lot about why so many of us feel clueless or simply uninterested in addressing end-of-life issues. If you don't buy Stephen's assessment, perhaps you would be interested in a consensus report put out by our National Institute of Medicine, and it was entitled Dying in America, Improving Quality and Honoring Individual Preferences Near the End of Life. And in this report, a committee of experts determined, it came out about 5 years ago, that we as Americans have work to do to not only enhance quality of life through the end of life, but also to contribute to a more sustainable care system. But how do we do it? That's the big question, isn't it? Culture change can be slow and difficult. For our News of the Movement segment today, I'd like to refer to a news article out of Canada from a publication called the Hamilton Spectator, and it's entitled, In Denial About Death, Our Aversion to the Inevitable Will Only Prolong Our Pain. And I've put that you can read lots of stuff like this. I mean, it's hitting papers like the New York Times and, you know, regularly I'm getting things from the news. But this was a really good article. It's long. I've posted the link to it at the Wheel Mysteries Facebook page. But I want to read an excerpt from it for you. Our death illiteracy means we are woefully unprepared to handle the growing number of aging people in our society, says Denise Marshall, associate professor of palliative care at McMaster University and the medical director of the Niagara West Palliative Care Team and McNally House Hospice. According to Marshall, unless we begin to talk about death, to befriend it, as Samuel says, we will see suffering on a massive scale. This is like the perfect storm in North America, says Marshall. There will be too many people with too many needs and not enough of us able to support them. We won't know what to do with all of these dying people in frailty. For concrete strategies to help combat our society's death avoidance, Marshall points to the work of her mentor, Dr. Alan Kelleher. Kelleher, a medical and public health sociologist, was the first to suggest that end-of-life care should be the responsibility of the entire community, not just medical professionals. His groundbreaking 2005 book, Compassionate Cities, argues that workplaces, charitable organizations, clubs, churches, and community members should work alongside doctors and palliative care clinicians to care for the dying and bereaved. The most effective way to foster this, says Marshall, is by adopting a good old-fashioned public health approach. Jurisdictions across Canada should invest in advertising, workshops, and awareness campaigns encouraging more conversation about death. We need for end-of-life care in Canada what we've done with smoking cessation. It's a good analogy, she said. It takes time. This is a psychic shift, unquote. Many European countries are already using this approach. In Ireland, coasters reading "Dying for a Beer" that described 10 ways to support a bereaved friend were distributed in pubs across the country as part of a public health campaign. In the United Kingdom, death education is part of the kindergarten curriculum. I gotta let that soak in. Continuing on, systemic changes like these are essential in order to handle the growing number of Canadians approaching the end of their lives, said Marshall. Currently, 70% of deaths occur in hospital, and there's simply not enough space in palliative care units, hospitals, and hospices to handle a major influx of the sick or dying. Quote, why is it a crisis? Because I don't think we've fully grasped the fact that this isn't going away. This is not a blip in society, Marshall said. We are living longer, with more complexities. 100% of us, though, are going to be at the end of life. Marshall points to China as an example of a jurisdiction facing a disproportionate number of dying people that completely outstrips the younger age group's ability to care for them. That will eventually be us. It will be every country, Marshall said. What we'll risk is seeing huge amounts of suffering in ways we haven't seen before. True abandonment. And then later she says, when the community becomes involved in death, everyone benefits. And that's the end of this segment of the article. The article also tells the story of Polly. And I wanted to share this story. A 91-year-old woman who had received permission to die at home after two strokes. Her daughter, Monica Plant, however, had already been her parents' live-in caregiver for nearly 7 years and had managed the emotional and daunting process of providing end-of-life care for her father, who had died at home 6 months earlier. And that might sound familiar to some of you, this kind of caregiving. And knowing that she could not do that again alone, Monica began pulling together a community of support. And the article describes what unfolded. Here we go. Plant reached out to her neighbors, her out-of-town siblings, and parishioners at Polly's church. Plant's neighbor went door to door along Undermount Avenue asking residents if they would like to help ease Polly into her final weeks of life. Within days, Plant's support system grew to 25 households who would visit with Polly, do yard work, bring meals, and provide Plant with some comfort and respite. Neighbors circulated emails containing meal plans and visiting schedules and swapped stories about how good it felt to come together as a community. The daughter says, Polly was somebody who liked things to happen organically, and that's how it happened. She compares the effort to an urban barn raising, a constructive, collective effort that allowed her mother to die in the comfort of her home. The experiences enriched both Plant and her neighbors, as well as creating an interconnection between those who were involved in Polly's care. It offered a glimpse of what we will all face at the end of our lives. Quote, what I think the byproduct of being able to die at home was that people on the street got to see what aging looks like. This is what happens at all the stages, Plant said. If you're taken out when you're retirement age and you go off to a retirement home, the neighborhood doesn't get a chance to see what happens when you age. Unquote. Polly died at home on November 30th, 2016, in the arms of Plant and her twin brother, the way she had always wanted. I love stories. I love stories that help us see how it could be. I became aware of this article thanks to my friend, Holly Pruitt, who has an excellent blog called Death Talk Project. She's from Portland. And I have posted her link at the Wheel Mysteries Facebook page. And one of Holly's blog posts is called A Village Making Death. And she talks in that about a new initiative of the Groundswell Project and Palliative Care Australia. So we've talked about Canada. We're talking about Australia. These are Western countries, pretty similar to America, and these are the cool things they're doing. So this project is called Compassionate Communities, and it's a whole community approach to end-of-life care where caring for one another at times of need, loss, and or crisis becomes the task and responsibility of everyone. What are compassionate communities? They are citizens who are knowledgeable and informed about death, dying, loss, and care, and they adapt their practices and behavior to meet needs that they encounter in their everyday lives. Services and local authorities play a significant role in providing and sustaining quality end-of-life care, but people from all walks of life should be involved in designing suitable end-of-life care policies that meet their needs. My friend Holly says, "In my own small way, I'm beginning something of the same, engaging in ongoing conversations with a small range of communities who are asking, what does it mean to die in community? Who are we to each other when it comes to death and dying? How can our going out from amongst each other leave our communities stronger?" These are my questions also. Many of us in Chico and the surrounding communities are very aware of our aging and also very active in our community, but still very uncertain about how to create the community we want and need as we approach the end of our lives. I don't have answers, but I encourage each of us to consider the questions. Do you relate to Stephen Jenkinson's theory that our personal responses to death and dying are rooted in a deeper cultural vacuum when it comes to end-of-life stuff? How do we fix that? Have you experienced community inaction when someone has died? How did that make you feel to be a part of it? Do you have an idea of who will be there for you when you near the end of life? Have you talked to them about it? And if not, why not? So for our American Death segment today, we'll hear local retired educator Barbara Roberts tell her story of her husband Don's death during treatment for AL amyloidosis. I asked Barbara to share her story because we're both a part of Chico Friends Meeting, the Quaker meeting in town, and I watched that community offer support while Don was going through his treatment. I also officiated at his memorial, and I saw how Barbara was surrounded by community, the Friends Meeting, her Valley Oaks Village co-housing community, her family and Don's, her women's circle friends, so much community. But her story had an interesting learning point for me, and you will probably get it too, as we listen to Barbara tell her story on this American death. Here we go. One moment.
Roberts, I was a kindergarten teacher at Blue Oak Charter School. My husband, Don Roberts, was a counselor at Butte County Behavioral Health. He was my husband and loving companion for 20 years. We have one son, Thomas, who went to Parkview, Marsh, and Chico High. He was an EMT, and now he's studying to become a physician's assistant. In 2006, my husband was diagnosed with a very rare blood disease called AL amyloidosis. After his diagnosis, we went to Boston twice for treatments, and he passed away a year and a half after the treatment began. The disease came back, and so we had to go back to Boston a second time. And when we were flying out to Boston the second time, We're also very hopeful. And as the treatments were being made, he was doing really well. He made it through big chunks of the treatment doing fine. And then all of a sudden, things started not working. And within a few days, he died. And so it was a total shock. All the doctors thought he was doing great. The nurses, I would talk to the nurses a lot, and they would talk about other patients. And Don was really strong and doing great. So it was a shock to everyone that he didn't make it. We were in Boston at the hospital. My two sisters-in-law, Don's brother, his cousins, and my son came out. He was connected to lots of tubes. He was able to hear us, but he was not able to speak back to us. I remember my son holding his hand and talking to him and crying because Don couldn't speak back to him. So he passed away as we were all singing hymns, and he passed away peacefully. As we were singing hymns from our hymnal, some of the nurses and doctors came in and sang with us. We decided to have his body cremated, and I flew across the country with his box of ashes. And I remember being in the plane writing a song to him as we were flying across the country. When we arrived home, the first thing that we found was that my co-housing, Valley Oaks Village neighborhood, they had gathered on the day after Don passed away, and they had made about 150 folded flying cranes, and they were all strung together with ribbons, and they were hanging all over the house. It was beautiful. Our neighbors brought meals over to us each day. People were always reaching out, offering to help in any way that they could. One of my son's closest friends would come over and just sit near my son, Thomas, and be with him. In the early days, I was in shock and disbelief. I remember at the memorial, I didn't even cry. I hadn't really found my feelings yet. I had a group of women friends with whom I met monthly, and our group was led by a local counselor, Marilyn Jennings, and so they were there with me as I was going through this. During our women's groups, we often did an art project, and I have a photo and I have detailed memories of a sand tray art piece that I created and also of a painting that I did. This healing technique that I created for myself, I called it Screaming Underwater. And I started doing it during our second visit to Boston when I was just overwhelmed with what was going on. So I would dive into the water and I would do the crawl stroke. And each time I took a stroke and blew out air into the water, I would scream into the water. So all my anger and disbelief and just craziness was blown into the water. And then I would take another stroke and scream into the water. And I would keep swimming laps, screaming into the water, until I was finished screaming out my anger. And then I would do a backstroke, and all kinds of other feelings would come out. Fear, sadness, disbelief. And what I would do is, feelings would come out as I would blubber my lips together, blow air through my lips. All those feelings were coming out. And I would swim laps after laps until all those feelings were out. And then I would do the breaststroke and I would cry. And I would keep crying lap after lap until I was finished crying. And then I would dive into the water and, well, actually before that, I would float on my back and I would just float without moving any parts of my body until all that I could feel was the water against my cheeks as I was floating with my eyes closed. And I would just float, just relaxing. And then I would dive under the water and look for sparkles, like looking for some kind of hope for the time ahead of me. And this practice of screaming underwater, I started during the second treatment in Boston, and then I continued doing this through my many years of grieving after Don passed away. Whenever I would feel feelings coming up, I would go to the pool. I would try to go when other people weren't there, and I would swim lap after lap, screaming and then crying and then floating, etc. It was very healing. I found that there's such a huge amount of energy behind the anger and the sadness, and the just huge amount of energy. And it really helped me to scream out my energy, my sadness, into the water. So at about 10 years, the grieving started to come to a close. And currently it seems like a long time ago that he passed away. And life goes on. We had so much loving community surrounding us. Our neighbors, Valley Oaks Village, the co-housing community, Chico Friends Meeting, the Quakers, Don's family, my family, and many other friends in Chico and from places far away, with so much support and love surrounding us. But still, inside myself was this very challenging journey that I had to make on my own. It was a very alone, lonely place that I had to travel through.
Oh, as a Quaker, I feel like I need to take some silence just to let that story soak in. I thank Barbara so much for sharing her story. But the radio doesn't like silence, so I will move on. I wonder what thoughts did Barbara's story bring up for you? I think Barbara's experience is a good example of the ways community can be there for us during and immediately after a death. And it was also a reminder to me that as community, we must know how to be with someone and support someone, even as they walk the road of loss on their own and in their own way. Do we know how to do that? Have you ever avoided someone after a death because you did not know how to be with the enormity of their grief? What support is available in our community for the bereaved? So this topic of grieving and how to support those who are grieving is another very important show and a very important conversation that we can be having with each other. But we're going to save that for some other night on the wheel. For now, I would like to take a moment to thank our underwriters. The Wheel's made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Affordable Automotive, locally owned by Mike Button and family since 1996. Affordable Automotive grows their business one customer at a time, repairing or maintaining any car, truck, or SUV, ensuring a safe and reliable vehicle. Affordable Automotive also has financing available at 2106 Park Avenue in Chico. Appointments are available by calling 892-1774 and at chicoautomotive.com. Voted best in Chico the last 6 years in a row. And we're also supported tonight by ChicoCallCenter.com. Since 1999, ChicoCallCenter.com has been assisting businesses and nonprofits with their call center needs for marketing, fundraising, polling, surveys, customer service, and much, much more. ChicoCallCenter.com can provide vital information about your customers' needs to help plan, focus, and grow your organization. More information or for employment opportunities, visit ChicoCallCenter.com. All righty. So, the day before his death in a helicopter crash, our musician who died in the month of August relayed to his bandmates a disturbing dream he had where he witnessed his own funeral. I resonated with this story because I have had an experience of having a very vivid dream of a friend the day before he died. Have you ever had that happen or had a friend or family member report it? How does that happen? How do we get these warnings or goodbye visits in dreams before someone dies? Are we connected to each other in ways we don't even begin to understand? It is a mystery. If you haven't already guessed who he is, we can reveal an answer to one of this show's big questions by taking a short musical break to feature The Sky is Crying by Stevie Ray Vaughan. Let's see here. Stevie Ray Vaughan, what a loss. Stevie Wonder and Bonnie Raitt saying, whoops, hold on a second. What is that?
Yes.
Oh, we have Trailing on the line. Hold on a second, Trailing. Hey, Trailing. Hold on 1 second.
Yes.
I'm going to just read a little bit here about Stevie Ray Vaughan because I have a request for our listeners. You know, at Stevie Ray Vaughan's funeral, Stevie Wonder and Bonnie Raitt sang Amazing Grace. And I found a clip, but I couldn't find a full recording of that. So I know there are those people out there who can find anything online. And I want you to try to find it for me, and I'll post it at the Wheel Mysteries where we can all enjoy it. So now, as someone who's been involved with the international movement to get people thinking and talking about end-of-life issues, I'm frequently hearing news out of Boulder, Colorado. So for tonight's topic of death and community, we're going to look to Boulder, where it seems to me there is a community, or perhaps more specifically, a number of different communities coming together to create a more death-friendly culture in that town. So to learn more, I've invited Trailing Two to join me in conversation about her experience of death and community in Boulder. Trailing is a mother, a Waldorf school teacher, and a community member who has volunteered offering home death care to families for over 10 years. I met Trailing at the Sacred Gateways Conference in Sacramento in 2018, where I was moved by the power of her stories and by the sweet calmness of her presence. Hi, Trailing. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Rebecca. So good to be here.
When we talked earlier this week, you said something that really cracked me up. You said, I had no idea I would be working with dead bodies. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about what brought you to do the work you do with families when a loved one has died?
Yes. As you said, I'm a teacher. I'm a mother. My daughter is first year in college, so I'm kind of out of the woods. And so I'm focusing on teaching. And when community has events such as death, I participate. But I never thought I will be doing this. I think I shared with you one time when I was away for 3 days, and one day I picked up my daughter and her friend in the car, and her friend said, "So what did you do last weekend?" I said, "No, nothing, just hung out with friends, because my mother was taking care of dead people." at that point, I realized that's how my daughter look at what I do. But yes, it's true. I take care of dead people. I and many, many others in our community that will come together when there's a death event. And so it all started with a teacher who passed away with our families around. In fact, she was just divorced, and her husband was driving two of her children, one in third grade and one in first grade, on their way to California, and she was on the phone with him to say goodbye. And it was very sad because she was alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't there. I arrived 2 minutes after she passed away. And I got a phone call from our daughter's teacher, Mrs. Fox, saying that Gail has passed away. Would you please come? And of course, we are all in the community. I will come and do whatever I can. But when I arrived, she passed away. And we had pretty dramatic scene because they were all kind of shocked. I don't think any of them have seen dead people before. So they were sort of holding their breath. And when I walked in, they all let out of their sadness. So I stood there in shock as well. And so we did sort of our goodbyes, and people, all the parents in our class left one by one until the main lesson teacher, Mrs. Fox, and I. And the nurse came and said, "So who is related to this person?" And we look at each other. "No, we are not related." But Mrs. Fox says, "I'll be teaching tomorrow, so I guess you will take her home." And I thought, okay, I will take her home. Just tell me what I need to do. She said, "Well, call this lady. Her name is Karen Van Baron, who has been doing and helping this." I said, "Okay." So literally, Gail fell on my lap, and I stepped into the role of caregiver, death caregiver, from that moment on.
Wow.
And that has been a wonderful journey.
Yes, for more than 10 years. And why don't you tell us a little bit about, I mean, it's not in every community that someone would say, "Well, why don't you take her home?" But I know in Boulder, that particularly because of the work of Karen, that it is more normal for people to say take her home. And in California, it's Sebastopol, where Jerry, Grace Lyons
yes,
is.
But Grace,
why don't you tell us a little bit about how you think that sort of culture came about in Boulder?
You know, it really came about the last 15, 20 years. It's not like it has been long established here. It's one by one that people are educated when they attend the home vigil. So over the years, after we do the body care, when we look after someone and we do the whole thing, we set up the home vigil for them, there will be people coming, friends, community members, loved ones, people from other states come to pay their visits to the deceased. And it is through that event, through that process, they learn about home vigil. And it's really a life-changing experience. And that's what I experienced.
Yes.
I Yes, Boulder, it's always been a very alternative town and very conscious about everything from recycling to political correctness to you name it, we have
spiritual stuff. Naropa University yes. is there. And I know
right,
that Karen
that's
produces
right.
a beautiful magazine called Natural Transitions out of Boulder.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
but I think you're
I highly
right.
I recommended that.
Yeah, yes. I'll put the link to that.
Is filled with so many wonderful information and people's testimonies and their experience. People pour their heart out for what they've been through with the home funeral. That's what most people commonly call it, home funeral or home death care.
And I think you're right. I think that it's not until you actually experience it yourself that you realize how different it can be. How it reminds me of the home birth movement, really. And not yes. everybody is going to want a home birth. Not everybody's going to want a home death care. That's okay. But for those who do, or for those who want to experience any part of it, you know, some people, I remember the home funeral that I attended here in Chico, some people did not feel comfortable going into the bedroom where Iona was laid out, but they were very
correct.
Comfortable being in the dining room and chatting with people, and people were, yeah, so it, experiencing
that's
it
right.
once
that's
makes
right.
makes a
you,
big
you
difference.
All kinds.
Yeah.
Some people, children come in, they are the most natural
yes.
response. They come through, that person really looks like they are asleep.
Yeah.
I mean, I always said that sleep is the little brothers of death, you know.
Mm.
When we sleep, we are dead.
Mm.
I mean, it's very similar. So I think we often emphasize on the dead people.
Yeah.
But really, what this is about, is about honoring the event,
yeah.
honoring the rebirth, creating a heart space to be with each other, to acknowledge a life past.
Yes.
And now, that's really what this is about.
And you, when we were in Sacramento, you told a powerful story about a death where that almost didn't happen. And it was such an important death that you and Karen pulled off. And I want to make sure we get
yes.
that story in. So why don't you go ahead and would you mind telling us that story?
Sure. I'd love to share that story. That's probably one of the highlights in my life. And that's probably also why I do what I do. So we belong to this Waldorf community in Boulder. We have two schools here, Boulder Valley and Shiny Mountain. And a few years ago, after school finished, the children take their class trip, and, you know, we had happy air in our environment because summer vacation is about to begin. So one morning, my daughter, my husband, we have our breakfast together, and I was reading the newspaper, local newspaper, and it says seventh grader by the name of Sophia drowned in Boulder Canyon, Boulder Creek. And I thought, Sophia, we have a Sophia. We have a Sophia in seventh grade. So when I was repeating that to myself, my daughter Cindy goes, Mom, that's our Sophia. That's from our school. That's the grade behind me. I said, Sophia? Oh, my heart just sunk.
Mm-hmm.
And then a message came in from the Shiny Mountain, the school, saying we will have a gathering together for Sophia's passing at 2 o'clock that afternoon. So, of course, nearly a couple hundred people showed up. The mother was there. She couldn't even stand up. She was held. And the father was there. So this is how what happened. The father was driving the twin sisters, Sophia and her sister, they're two, One is sort of bigger and one is smaller. So we have been the smaller one. They were driving down the canyon, Boulder Canyon, and I believe there was a car in front of them stopped looking for bear or letting bear cross the road. The father tried to avoid hitting the car in the front, kind of veered towards to the embankment. The car slipped and both children were in the water. So the father went after the little one, Sophia, brought her onto a rock, went back out to get the bigger one. And when he brought the bigger one back, Sophia was washed away again.
Mm.
It took hours and hours and hours to fish her out. It was probably 4 hours. Finally, they got her. And 4 hours, that's a long time in the river. I don't really know how many hours, but it was high water. So we had so many people, divers in there, try to catch her.
So I'm going to have to cut in and say, tell us about what happened, because I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. I know how the story goes, but we must be sure to get to what was happening with the mother
thank
and the
you
community.
For reminding me.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm reliving the experience.
I'm sure. But, it's such an amazing story.
Yes. So when I got to the school, I had somebody told the mother that I would like to talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yeah, okay. You know, she wasn't there. Well, she didn't connect with me, nothing. That night, Karen and I, we were there. And Karen says, well, we have to get to her. I say, yes, we have to get to her. Because this is going to be a big trauma if we don't get to her and her husband. So that night we phone her, and I phone her and I say, Laura, so where is Sophia? She said, well, Sophia is in the hospital, and she will go in to get an autopsy. And after that, we'll have her cremated, and that's what we are going to do. I say, Laura, you know what I do. You probably know what I do, but let me just explain to you. So I was on the phone with her for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
She was not listening. The next day, I said, so where will you be tomorrow? She said, well, I'll be going to the funeral home. That's right by my house.
Mm-hmm.
I will be signing the paper. We'll pick out the coffin casket, and we'll have her cremated. I said, okay, so can I just see you for 5 minutes tomorrow morning? She said, well, I don't know why, but yeah, sure, you can come. The next morning, Karen and I waited there. Well, actually, they were there before us. When we walked up, she was getting ready to sign paper. I just barged in, and I said, listen, Laura, just give me 5 minutes. And I asked the other gentleman to leave. You know,
yeah.
I was in a pretty strong, assertive mode. I said, before you sign it, just give me 5 minutes. But within that 5 minutes, and the husband was there too, I said, Laura, listen, our son died in a plane crash. I never had a chance to say goodbye. I want you to say goodbye to your daughter. It will mean so much to her. She said, she's a mess. She's been in the water for so long. She's a mess. She's all banged up. I said, that's okay, Laura. Not to worry about that. She is beautiful. You know that. And we will be sure when you see her, she will be beautiful. Then Karen chimed in and said, when my brother died in the hospital, I never had a chance to see him. He was 9 years old. This is why we do what we do, because we want you to have a chance to say goodbye.
Yeah. And then I remember, what I remember you saying is that then when she agreed, she said you had to have it done by a certain time. And it was the moment when you realized that you and Karen were not going to be able to pull this thing off alone. And you started, you had she gave you a very short window.
That's right.
And you started pulling in the troops, just saying, you do this, you do this, you do this. And
That's exactly what we did.
I remember,
once we got the agreement, we did not have a place because they did not want to do it in their home.
Yeah.
So we called the community, we asked for a place. And finally, a wonderful woman with a yoga studio came through.
And
it was great.
Yeah, and there were people who brought things. I can't believe that I can't, like, I wanted to talk about the elements of ritual, that this is exactly, I know we have just another minute left before I'm going to go to my wrap-up. I'm going to have you back, Trailing, because I've realized I spent too much time talking. I'm new at this, so I'm figuring it out. But tell us just in a minute what, and I know that's hard, but when you think about ritual and community, because ritual, whenever we're talking about community, we're talking about what they do when they come together. So just list off a couple of the key things that you think are important when you're coming together as community at the time of a death.
Yes, we had 2 hours to put everything together. So Karen and I went to work. We call on the mothers in her class, seventh grade class, to come help if they are willing. And interestingly, 7 mothers showed up, and we had the we picked up the body from the coroner's because she had to have the autopsy. We put her on the table. All the mothers came with such a beautiful hand and touches. Some of them washed the hair. Some of them washed the face. Some of them, if you can picture that, it's like working with angels. At the end, when she was ready to be presented to the mother and the father for their goodbyes, it went out with the flowers in their hand in a single file and invite the parents in to anoint the daughter. And that is the ritual. A ritual comes from your heart. When everything comes together spiritually, I have never seen anything more beautiful than that single file of women in white with the flowers in their hand after they care for this beautiful little maiden.
Oh my gosh, that is such a beautiful story, and I thank you for telling it. I loved it the first time I heard it, and I love it again. And you have much wisdom to share, and I really appreciate your time tonight. I wish I could talk to you for another hour, and I will do better next time. But thank you, Trailing.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, and thank you for the work you do and the work that everyone in Boulder is doing to to help make it a more death-friendly place. And you have a good night.
Yes. You too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Trailing. Good night. Wow. So we're down in the final minutes of our show. And I wonder what you think about a community that could pull together like that. And I have to tell you, she lost her son. This story was about a child, and it's one of the times when I think allowing a family to care for their own dead is most poignant. But that's my opinion, and it's not for everyone. The question I have for you, I mean, your exit plan tip tonight is to think about what community means to you. Who is your community? Is it your family? I mean, even when we're not close, it's often our family who step in to care for us before and after our deaths. Are there relationships that need to be mended? Are there wishes that need to be communicated? I'm encouraging you to tend to those things now before you become too frail to do so. Does your community extend to your friends? My friends have all gotten together with food and wine and sat around and talked about our advanced directives together. More importantly, we had conversations that will guide us as a small, close-knit group of friends as we head into later life. And not everybody has friends. So perhaps your question is the bigger question. How do we communicate? How do we cultivate a community, you know, here, like the compassionate communities described? So we've reached the end of our show. I'm going to post a lot of good links at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook. We also have a website at befriendingdeath.org. And I'm going to go out with one more Stevie Ray song. And thank you all for listening. Until next time, remember, friends, talking about death won't kill you.